Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now please join me in welcoming my co-host, Rick Hudat Hess.
Okay, Mike, that when you say it that way, I really feel Narlands, baby.
Well, how should I say it? Let me coach me a little bit.
I'm not so sure I can pull it
Hudat
off.
Hudat! Is that better?
Well, now did
try
you
again. Rick Hudat Hess.
Well, that's a little more energy.
Is that better?
Did you see that the NFL has claimed copyright over Hudat?
I did, but they have given up, I understand.
Well,
they were going after some small business owner in New Orleans. I understand that they have, after big public outcry, they've stepped back.
Somebody down there, I think, I can't remember who that guy was, came up with Hudat claimed they own the rights to Hudat, which I thought was one of those meta things that's kind of fun.
Nice. So who are you rooting for this weekend, Rick?
I really don't care much.
No.
I guess the Saints.
Yeah.
How about you?
But this is interesting. The Saints, how come? Out of sympathy for the Hurricane? Rick Tough Love Hess doesn't strike me as the kind of guy who would root for a football team just because their city got hit by a devastating hurricane.
Nah, it's more because I dislike Peyton Manning.
Oh, okay.
And the Colts.
Really?
Yeah. They moved out of Baltimore in the middle of the night.
Yeah, and that's a good reason. That's a good reason.
Omnipresent in all those commercials.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. And I like Peyton more than his brother. His brother kind of grates.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we'll see how it goes.
But how about you? Who are you pulling for, baby?
Yeah, no, you know, I think I'm rooting for the Saints.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, look, you got to have sympathy for this city. You know, it's a heartwarming story to have their football team go all the way to the Super Bowl. So.
Okay.
But you know what else is heartwarming?
What?
Some of the topics that we're going to talk about today on the Education Gadfly Show.
Wow, nice segue.
Thank you. We're going to start with Pardon the Gadfly. Then we're going to hear Amber's Research Minute, and Stafford will rate that reform. Mickey is out. He just had surgery.
What kind of surgery, pray tell?
Shoulder surgery.
Uh-oh.
So making it very difficult for him to do his job here on the Education Gadfly Show.
I hope he's feeling better.
He is hopefully feeling better. Mickey, shout out to you.
Mm-hmm.
But in his place, we've got Janie, and she is ready. It's a special edition this week, Rick. We're going to do an all Arnie Duncan edition.
Wow.
Of Pardon the Gadfly. Janie, let's get started.
All right, we've got some simple questions for the all Arnie Duncan edition. First, Mike and Rick, what do you think about Duncan's proposed education budget?
I mean, there's not that much to it, frankly. I mean, other than the fact that we're supposedly tightening our belts and not kicking the can down the road by spending several billion more, you know, there's some marginal add-on programs that are going to be competitive grants. And otherwise, I don't see a whole lot of news here.
Well, look, there is some news. So first of all, in Congress, it seemed like, at least last year, it was looking like that we had a new normal, right? That we had these huge increases under the stimulus, and it looked like Congress wanted to set that as the starting point going forward. Well, this budget goes back to sort of pre-stimulus days and sets things like Title I and special ed at sort of the old normal, and, you know, makes some increases in some cases, but I think that's a big difference. Now, it still increases funding on education, but it doesn't increase it as dramatically mm-hmm. as some of their friends on Capitol Hill would want them to.
But it's also got the $1 billion bonus for Congress, which suggests to me
yes.
that the administration doesn't understand the U.S. Constitution as well as I might like them to.
Right. This is that if Congress reauthorizes the law this year, there will be an extra $1 billion for education thrown in.
Right. The problem is that Article 1 of the Constitution actually stipulates that it's Congress that appropriates funds.
Yes, yes. Well, there's
Whoops.
That. This whole thing is a request. But look, I also think that this move to more competitive grants is a positive development. I think they have learned that you can get some serious leverage from competitive grants like Race to the Top. You know, putting another $1 billion in Title I isn't going to make any difference in the world. But, you know, another $1 billion to bribe states to pass reform-minded laws might make some margin.
Yeah, I mean, just two quick pushbacks there. I mean, on the whole competitive grant thing, right? One is that this works much better when we actually like the direction of administration than when we don't. And then the second, of course, is if you're going to shift from formulas to competitive grants, what matters is the credibility of the programs. And that's where we talked about last week. Arguably, the administration is not doing all that it needs to be. To really get its feet under it to establish these as credible programs.
Because they have secret panels. Okay, Janie, topic number two.
All right. Duncan's proposed changes to NCLB. What do you think?
Hoo-yah!
Okay.
Hudat! That's what I think.
Uh-huh.
I'm really excited about them, Rick.
Why is that, Mike?
Well, not just because they mirror the proposals that the Thomas B. Fordham Institute put out about 14 months ago.
You guys wrote language that vague and ambiguous regarding...
That's exactly what we do as a think tank. We write vague and ambiguous language, and that is that vague and ambiguous language has been picked up almost verbatim by the administration.
That schools...
It's only downhill from here, Rick.
So, since it's your language on the accountability piece, explain to me exactly what the language means.
First of all, this idea of getting rid of the 2014 deadline, of course we have to do that. And not just setting a new deadline, but saying, look, what we should be trying to do is by the time a child graduates from high school, we should be aiming to get them to be college or career ready. That makes a lot more sense than some arbitrary deadline of 2014. And to talk about proficiency, which has no meaning in the real world. So that's a positive step in the right direction. Lots else in here that, you know, indicating that that because we're going to be able to be tighter about our expectations for student learning because of the common standards and tests, that we might be able to loosen up on the micromanagement and allowing states more leeway at looking at growth over time. All of these smart, sensible positions. And yet I fear that some of the school reform hardliners out there are going to throw a fit.
Name some names, Mike.
Well, let's just say, so for example, we've had some things said and written by Margaret Spellings and by Sandy Kress in the last couple of days. You know, Sandy Kress saying, well, you know, JFK didn't, you know, said we're going to get a man on the moon in 10 years. And Johnson didn't come along and say, well, we're going to take 20 years instead. I mean, I just think that's a silly analogy.
Mm-hmm.
And Margaret Spellings, you know, saying that there might be a political price to pay if there's backing away from accountability. I mean, come on, people, let's figure out a way to do accountability in a way that's credible, that's smart, that's thoughtful. Let's not just try to have macho talk about who's tougher than the other person.
Okay, but you don't have some questions raised by this language around what the accountability is going to look like. It's mixed methods. Numbers matter, but we're not going to hold schools black and white accountable, but they'll be accountable. What's all this mean?
Look, I think that accountability a la No Child Left Behind made sense 10 years ago. It was important in that phase of education reform. I think what's more important right now is transparency, is getting information that we can trust, is having a system of measurement that we can trust that can be used for teacher merit pay and all kinds of other things. So I guess what I'm saying is I don't think, quote, accountability matters as much as, quote, transparency right now. Because you know what? Under accountability, nothing much actually happened anyway.
Mm.
Janie, topic number 3.
What are your thoughts on Duncan's recent statement that Hurricane Katrina was the best thing that ever happened to the education system in New Orleans?
Who dat? Rick, what do you think?
You know, I mean, I actually thought it was one of the few cases where I thought it wasn't just a faux unvarnished truth, but it was him actually saying something that was true and maybe not just useful, but accurate. I thought it was a shame. I think it's, you know, I thought it was the right thing to say, and I think it's a shame that he had to wind up, I guess, calling the mayor to apologize for it.
You know, this is the classic definition of a gaffe, right? It's when a politician is caught saying the truth. And everybody knows that the New Orleans system is much better today than it was before. But of course, we can't forget that there was this horrible tragedy that happened along the way.
Yeah, but I remember I read the Post, I think the day after he said it or so, ran kind of the full text of Duncan's remarks.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought he went out of his way to, you know, clarify that, oh, it's a horrible tragedy, of course. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that it took this for the school system to get a fresh start.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't think it does anybody any good when people have to quickly run for cover and apologize anytime they utter an inconvenient truth.
Mm. I mean, imagine if you had to run for cover every time you uttered an inconvenient truth, Rick.
Oof.
You'd be in pretty good shape, my friend. You'd be running and running.
Oof. It'd be ugly.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for our All Arnie Duncan, Pardon the Gadfly segment. Do you worry that our readers are going to think that we're obsessed with Inside the Beltway politics?
Yes.
Yes, that's probably true.
After last week's item on the leadership changeover in left-leaning think tank, I think we can pretty much take that to the bank.
All right. Well, you know what you can take to the bank also, Rick? Amber Winkler's Research Minute. Uh, Amber.
How you doing?
We're good. We're supposed to have snow any minute here in Washington. So come on, let's get this quick. Go for 59 seconds if you can.
I wore the wrong shoes for snow. All right, this week we have the latest edition of Hopes, Fears, and Reality, which is an annual charter school report published by the Center on Reinventing Public Education. This is the fifth edition, by the way. Contains six chapters of varying quality. I'll just put it that way. Some of which present empirical data, while others are thought pieces. Chapter one, which is going to be my focus here, presents useful descriptive data about the charter landscape from the last 4 years. Here's just a few nuggets. We've got roughly 4,700 charter schools nationally compared to 3,200 4 years ago. We know that it keeps inching up, though we still only have about 3% of students who are served in charters, which is up from 2% 4 years ago. Most of these students are, of course, in urban areas. In fact, almost 90% of all school districts in the U.S. do not have a charter school within their boundaries. Most of the growth is confined to about six states, including California, Florida, Wisconsin, where most of the closures have occurred as well. Nationally, based on current caps, this is a fun little factoid, there's room for how many charter schools, do you think, under current caps? Yeah, take a guess. I know I'm burning up time.
8,000.
Close. 955. Over half of which are in California. So bottom line, charter schools are still heavily concentrated in a handful of states and cities, and it remains to be seen whether Secretary Duncan's charge to lift caps will have a significant impact on expanding this growth beyond the usual suspects.
So who wrote that chapter you just talked about?
Robin Lake.
And who wrote the worst chapter?
Do we really want to do that?
Yeah, let's hear some call. We call this peer pressure.
No, bring come it on. Up. Hey, no, Amber, let me quibble with something. Okay, you know, we said, only went from 2% of the population to 3% of the population in 4 years. That's a 50% increase in 4 years.
You've got Mike brushed up on his stats.
I've been doing some math lately, baby.
I'm still in the big scheme of things. We're still talking about
if my portfolio had a 50% return in the last 4 years, mm-hmm. I would be feeling pretty good about things right about now.
I mean, isn't it true that there was sort of a kind of things had slowed down in the early 2000s and now they've kind of zoomed up again a little
bit? Yeah, I don't know if I'd say it's zoomed, but it's inched up. I mean, if you look at it, it's steadily inching.
But even that 4 years, Mike, I mean, you think about the exponential growth of kind of the late 90s.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, right? I mean, that 50% over 4 years is annual growth of about 11%. Mm-hmm. Right? So, I mean, that's steady growth, but it's certainly not that kind of rocket growth that
we
saw.
Which you would expect over time, mm-hmm. right?
Well, especially as the base of schools and kids gets larger, right?
Yep.
I mean, to see 25% annual growth in charter enrollment now is a half million kids. Mm-hmm. That's a whole lot of new schools.
They have it. Lots of good descriptive information. I mean, the other chapters kind of get into it. Although R. Terry in Ohio wrote a good chapter that was very realistic about, what you can expect when your charter school kind of gets in trouble.
Okay, so we've identified two. So among the other four, Amber's saying there's a couple of real duds. Is that how you're putting it?
So anyway, take it for what it's worth.
Listeners can go check it out for themselves. Okay, so what is the song?
All right, that goes with this, so this Amber? Is good. I'm excited about this one. Just a little background. 9th and 10th grade, my favorite rocker of all time. Blonde hair, spiky. Who is it?
Billy Idol.
So, most of charter schools are in the city, we have Hot in the City by Billy Idol.
Nice.
I would pay top dollar to see a picture of Amber in 9th grade in her Billy Idol getup. That must have been.
She spiked her hair for the concert.
You should check her out on Facebook. There's some pictures of Amber on Facebook. Are you friends with Amber on Facebook?
I'm not on Facebook.
So, Rick, you're about to launch your new blog on Education Week, edweek.org. Mm-hmm. So now that you're doing a blog, are you going to go into the social networking thing too? Facebook, Twitter?
No, one thing at a time. Now,
Jenna Twitters.
Jenna Twitters, that's right. So there you go. It's almost like Jenna. I Twitter.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think y'all wait for the next generation. The 2020s, I'm going to be all about Facebook and Twitter.
Good. But that's great.
Facebook won't exist.
I'm going to let them work the kinks out first.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I can't wait to have you in the blogosphere, Rick. We're going to have some fun.
Oh, and Jenna showed me the blurb you gave me, baby. I appreciate it. Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah, she wanted me to talk about how fun it's going to be to have Rick in the blogosphere. So I shared a few thoughts about how you put the happy in happy hour. And now the blogosphere is never going to be the same again.
We'll put the blah. I don't know what the hell.
You can put the blah in blogosphere. Put the blah. Okay. It's now time for Stafford to rate that reform. Today's is a special handwritten edition from Stafford Palmieri.
Hey now, don't hate. Don't hate. It's a good story.
Let's hear it, Stafford. Mike, you're full of hate, baby.
George and Charles Miriam are rolling over in their graves. I'm sure that the overhaulers of Noah Webster's famous An American Dictionary never thought that when they made it unabridged, that they would also be censored. The Menifee, I don't know how to pronounce this, but the Menifee Union School District in Riverside County, California, has removed copies of the Merriam-Webster Dictionary from all of its 4th and 5th grade classrooms because a parent complained that their child looked up the definition of oral sex. School officials are now reviewing dictionaries for other, quote, sexually graphic entries. Board member Rita Peters is now suggesting a committee to review all school books for age appropriateness. I'll just say that I think this story speaks for itself. A dictionary? You can't ban the dictionary! I'm sorry, and if such a thing existed, I would give this an F-. Menifee United School District in Riverside County, California. This is a terrible decision.
Stafford, are you going to give some pink slips here? Some Jeff Kooner honorary pink slips?
What is the definition? Do you happen to know what the definition is? I'm curious.
We are not talking about that on the show.
I did look it up. What's the definition?
In the Merriam-Webster, it is very benign. It is very benign and very euphemistic. Very euphemistic. Okay. All it right. is like the least graphic way to describe oral sex ever.
Do you recall it?
I am not going to say it on on air. I'm sorry.
I mean,
well, although, and here is a point. So back in the 90s, during the whole Monica Lewinsky thing, right? I mean, that sort of conversation was in the nation's newspapers. Were those newspapers banned as well?
And we talk about the need to prepare children to digest the news and act as responsible citizens. If they haven't mastered the concept of oral sex, how are they going to go to the polls and place judgment in something like the Lewinsky scandal?
I was going to say, shouldn't we be happy that kids are looking words up in dictionaries at all? Learning how to use paper dictionaries? I mean, everyone looks everything up online.
I mean, if you're going to get rid of dictionaries in this day and age, it's just because they're a waste of money compared to, you know, when you can get everything online.
If
right?
you put them online, then the Chinese, for instance, are just terrific at snipping out inconvenient words like democracy and freedom. Hey, look, there's no D's in this dictionary.
This is a conundrum.
But look, I mean, this actually, I'll go back to exactly where I came out the other week on the brown bear thing, mm-hmm. which is when we've got kids who are swimming in crazy stuff on TV, on the web, everywhere else, the notion that what we need to protect them from is those few kids who, God forbid, want to open a book and we're going to protect them from reading definitions, I think this is the least of our concerns.
All right. Whew. Well, Stafford throws the feared F-.
But I still don't know what the reform was.
The reform was removing the dictionaries from all the classrooms.
Is it really a reform?
Okay.
We have a loose definition here.
We have a loose definition decision.
Go look up Rate That Reform in the dictionary, Rick. Tell us what you find.
It sounds remarkable. I'm just saying it sounds remarkably like News of the Weird or Kooner's Pink
A reform is when you change your behavior after something happens, right? So they reformed their practice. Now the practice is not to have dictionaries in the classroom because kids could look up dirty words.
Rick has throwing the book at Stafford. All right, that is all the time we have for today. Until next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show, always available at excellence.net. Signing off.